Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula, Bill Russell. Thomas Frank, not to be confused with Frank Thomas, the baseball player you just told me. liberal state.
Yeah.
That used to have a meaning that was liberal arts.
It was broadly popular, too. I mean, it was
something
that
you
wanted to be. Yeah. You know. I'm on a one-man crusade to rescue the word liberal.
So we'll be on a three-man crusade. What do you say? So what does it mean that has been so trashed, much less forgotten?
Well, I mean, liberalism is certainly, you know, in the classical definition, is just this belief in you know, maximizing human freedom. And then it got updated in the 1930s. There's a famous definition from the 30s that I like, of liberalism, where it's freedom plus groceries.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Who did that?
Well, it was a congressman from Texas. Who
fabulous.
Said that.
You mean, yeah, something good did come out of Texas?
There used to be a lot of liberals from Texas. It's hard to believe. Like Lyndon Johnson, you know.
Used to be a lot of liberals from Kansas, but that's another subject.
And from Nebraska. They had a Republican senator called George Norris, and his nickname was the Fighting Liberal.
Well, Wisconsin, the home of Joseph McCarthy. McCarthy displaced
La Follette, right?
One of the great progressives of all time.
Yeah.
Fightin' Bob.
Yeah.
Not just any old senator. He displaced Junior.
Yeah.
Little Bob, I think they call him. But Fightin' Bob La Follette, Norris, these folks in the Midwest, which was a hotbed of taking care of each other.
That's right. A hotbed of kindness, a hotbed of niceness.
Holy cow.
How primitive.
I know, it's funny, isn't it?
Historians, though, to whom this is important. This is important to all of us because we've forgotten, along with the idea of liberal being
freedom plus groceries.
Fabulous. And what then is the liberal state?
The liberal state is where it's the traditional 19th century capitalist state, but with all the safeguards thrown in, okay? With the Keynesian economics, with the, you know, regulated financial markets, with a safe workplace, with a labor union so that people can have some voice at the place that they work. It is just, it's democracy applied to economics.
I wondered if that word would come into this.
What?
Democracy, that much abused word. Democracy in the economic system.
The liberal state is economic democracy. So it's democracy not only in politics, but also in the world of economics. And that's what has been undone. That's what's been under such brutal attack for 30 years.
And with that goes an attack on social democracy.
Yeah. Yeah, and the word liberal now, I mean, means snob. Or something. God, where was I the other day? And I heard someone called someone a liberal as like an imprecation, like they, you know, just yelling at somebody on the street. You goddamn liberal!
No.
Yeah.
Just because they didn't like them.
Yeah. Or they, I mean, yeah. And
it was probably Saturday night in Iowa City.
I don't remember where it was, but it was really shocking to me. Yeah. And I was just walking along. It might have been in Iowa City. I don't know. Yeah, and it was a funny thing. There's no physical marks to identify the person as a liberal, but it was just an insult, right? And now it means snob. It means, you know, this sort of intellectual, but intellectual in the hated sense, not in the sense like that we respect learning or something like that. But you know, somebody that's read a lot of books and wants to interfere in every aspect of your life. It means a kind of upper class tyrant, and it's been given this sort of class definition.
And coming from the people who are the ruling, as it were, class.
Oh, Paula.
I know.
Where to begin?
Yes.
Look.
Yes.
Yes, what
you're
saying is true.
But isn't that part of the dilemma?
Yeah.
Where to begin?
That is what you're saying is true, that this definition has been applied to them very successfully by people who represent the actual ruling class in this country, i.e., big business, the very wealthy, high net worth individuals, you know, the great fortunes, that sort of thing. They're the ones that funded and led the attack on liberalism ever since the 1930s, and it's only come into flower since the 1970s.
And the funded part was really, really important, because this was a very considered, conscious act on the part of those who were, as you say, business, the high net worth individuals, the big fortunes.
They hated Roosevelt, but
Roosevelt, that's 70 years ago.
But that's when they started. That's when they started, you know, counterattacking. And they got nowhere for a very long time. And it wasn't until the 60s and
70s. Now, why would that be that they got nowhere? There's a line in this book I read by Thomas Frank called The Wrecking Crew that says, the people actually liked the liberal state.
They still do. If you do polls all the time, do people like Social Security? Hell yeah. And then ask them, well, do you like the even better? How about the idea of having a secure retirement? People really like that. How about the idea of having pure food? You know, how about the idea of having, food that doesn't poison you and have making sure that that's the case?
Healthcare.
Oh, people dig that.
How do we feel about healthcare?
People would like to be able to afford healthcare. People, the idea that if a member of your family gets sick, that you're going to go bankrupt, turns out that's a really unpopular situation. People don't like that.
And that all is embedded in the idea of the liberal state.
Mm-hmm. That's liberalism.
I want to go back to Paula's original question, which is what happens when they cheat? And this is, I've been thinking about it a long time because we've had a long time to think about it, more than 8 years, 40 years, plus or minus, depending on where you start. And it seems there are two problems with the cheaters. One, a lot of their cheating is illegal. And then the question is one of how does one enforce, can the laws be enforced and will the laws be enforced, which is one issue with it. The other, and in some ways it's sort of an existential challenge, is that this approach is not sustainable.
You mean the current cheating approach?
Well, you, at some point you run out of somebody to steal from.
Yeah. As we're finding out right now.
Exactly. We've sort of cleaned out this house, we're now borrowing from the Chinese, various Middle Eastern countries, Russia.
We're all going to be working for the Qatari Sovereign Wealth Fund.
If we're lucky.
Yeah.
That's
capitalism
in
action. That's
not funny.
I'm sorry. Look, Paula, you wonder why I think that, why I laugh at all this stuff. And there is no way to write a book like this and without taking the kind of ironic attitude that I have. Otherwise, you would go mad. It's too depressing. It's too awful. And it's also too systematic. I mean, one of the things that I couldn't believe when I was writing this is like, why hasn't someone written this book yet? Why do I have this field all to myself? It's not funny. What the hell is going on?
Yeah.
One of the real insights in this book that I went back and just sort of savored is something called the Jamba Declaration.
Yeah. Unbelievable. I had no idea
about
this.
And I think in some ways that sort of is almost a paradigm for all of what's gone on in the last, 30 years. 40 years is a nice round number. Tell me about the Jamba Declaration.
Okay, well, there's a lot of backstory to it. This is
truncated.
I'll give you a 1.5 minute backstory and then get to Jamba.
Okay. Look, when I wrote the book, I settled on several different narrative strategies that I would take. I would describe Washington physically. I would describe the systems of government and how they've been wrecked. And I would describe the career of Jack Abramoff, who seemed to me to be the ideal man of conservative Washington, D.C., really the ideal figure because
he's had been a long time.
Well, yes.
And you're doing this not because he is a bad apple.
No, he's a representative. Jack Abramoff was a great idealist. He was the protege of leaders of the movement. He was the movement for a while. Yeah, he was the leader. And he would surface here and there in all these different places that you would never expect. He was the head of the College Republicans. He ran a think tank. He had a role in Iran-Contra. And then one of the stranger things that he did is he was running a, I don't know what you would call it, a grassroots group in D.C. And he somehow... he had developed this fondness. He'd been doing this in the College Republicans for right-wing guerrilla movements around the world. He and his friends, and this was a big deal, this is the Reagan years. Remember, we had the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, we had the Contras in Nicaragua, but there were other ones. There was a right-wing group fighting in Mozambique, and there was a right-wing group fighting in Angola. Some of these guys were incredibly bad, okay? They were what we would call now terrorists.
We were funding them.
These are all people on our side.
Some of them are running armies, though. I mean, this is goes beyond just. I mean, it was terrorism. It was terrorism by organized armies.
Oh, of course, right. And what I mean is like planting landmines all over Angola and that sort of thing, slaughtering civilians,
rape, mutilation, the full litany. Not nice people.
No,
gets us to Jamba.
It does, as a matter of fact. Okay, so there was this, on the right, there was this this cult of what they called the Freedom Fighter, okay, meaning all these different right-wing guerrilla groups. And the idea occurred to them that what they really needed to do was get all these guys together in one place and have a kind of right-wing Woodstock. And it was their grand scheme, their sort of cultural pattern that they were always after was to do what the left had done in the 60s, but everything in reverse. So, like, they would have big protests where they'd all be wearing ties, you know?
Important.
Symbolically, it was, and it was a really good fundraising strategy as well. You know, take the tactics of the left, but use them on the right. And they really took this, they went much farther than the left and were much more successful than the left, as you notice, once you, Jack Abramoff became one of the most successful lobbyists in Washington history. But anyhow, so they decided they'd have this big get-together of all these right-wing guerrilla groups in territory liberated by force of arms from a Soviet client state in Angola. And they were going to do it at the guy that, of all the freedom fighters, the one they loved most was this fellow called Jonas Savimbi in Angola. And he was a very charismatic guy. He always walked around with a big pistol on his hip and this sort of thing. And they all got together and they got some people from Afghanistan, some Contras, some, I think, people from Laos or something like that, and brought them all to Savimbi's hideout.
A few Nazis, didn't they? Right.
You said so.
They came in later. That was a different meeting.
Just want to be sure.
That was meeting number two. That was and then they went to...
That was Altamont, right?
You know, if I left that joke in, I believe I removed that joke to compare that this was the Altamont of
you
the...
You didn't leave it in, but
this,
it
the first one was the Woodstock, the second one was the Altamont. But I believe I cut... How did you guess? I cut that out of
so
the book.
So it was screamingly obvious. Besides, I was at Altamont.
Oh, no.
Okay. We're going to come back with that moment when we return. Be with us.